clubs in, is it all right?
Here. Yes.
The Grow Your Clubs in New York City. We have a clubhouse on 60th Street. And I met with the nominating committee and fortunately was elected into the group, and I've enjoyed that very, very much. So,
what are some of the things that they
This is much like the Pittsburgh Bibliophiles, and these people all have various interests in books or about books, and I think that there's something like 160 resident members and 160 non-resident members. That number, that could be up or down a little bit. So that's what it's limited to. And so recently, Doug Knight was elected into that. And I was one of his sponsors. We've been able to maintain our friendship. Also at Duke was a man who's now the vice chancellor in charge of health affairs, Bill Anlian, who is a rather interesting fellow. And I just met him for the first time when I served on that committee and have retained a friendship with him since that time. The interesting thing about Bill is, as I recall, this was in 1967 when I was on that committee, and that's when the war broke out in Israel, Seven-Day War. So that also found me as the head of the UJA in McKeesport, and so I had to drop everything I was doing and enlist as much help as I could into the UJA and, of course, raise money at that time, which was the thing for the war. I wrote Bill Anlian a letter and told him that I just had to forgo some of the things I was doing at Duke, but I'd get back to him as soon as the war was over. Well, I didn't realize that at the time he wrote me kind of a funny letter back. He said, well, what's this have to do with the Arabs? And of course, he was an Egyptian. But Bill's a great friend of Israel and always has been. And he is one of the greatest educator in medicine today in this country. And he has developed probably a school that ranks 1, 2, 3 in medicine at Duke, he himself being a Yale graduate. And we have been able to enjoy a friendship with him. So that really, my Duke connection has been a very strong one, and I feel that very close to school and really thankful I went there, and so therefore trying to do what mm-hmm. I can for them.
That's nice. I'm talking about your social life at Duke a little bit. You came from a rather sequestered life in McKeesport.
I hope it wasn't that sequestered, but we did take the trolley to Pittsburgh. But down at Duke, we also, my brother came to Duke, too. My brother's education was interrupted by the war. He did serve, and then he came back. And when he came back, I was still in medical school. So we did enjoy a very nice social life down there. In fact, we got to know the town people quite well. And to this day, if we go down, we usually see them or somehow or other communicate with them and keep up our relationships. So there was a social life, and
you said the townspeople were the Jewish townspeople.
Yes.
You weren't with the greater community at large.
Well, as much as they were. I mean, uh-huh. There were some people whom we were involved with, and these people in turn were involved with other townspeople, which mm-hmm. took us into that. And there were campus groups in this. And at that time, there were also a army camp there, Camp Butner, so there was a great spread of people mm-hmm. who kind of congregated on Saturday nights or things of that sort mm-hmm. to have some fun. And usually it was in one of the homes of one of the town people. One of the great Jewish families, Sarah Evans, I think, was the national president of Hadassah, mm-hmm. lived in Durham, North Carolina. Her husband, I only know him as Mutt, I'm trying to think of what his first name really was, the mayor of Durham, mm-hmm. and their two children made names for themselves. Bob Evans was, I think, with CBS as a commentator, and uh, actually wrote, authored a few books. So there were people there who were prominent people and who really had great feeling, I mean, really dedicated people.
Mm-hmm. When you dated, did you date only Jewish girls?
As a rule, I would say. If it was a Gentile girl, it certainly wasn't in a serious vein. I mean, that was kind of... Although I think that I may have had some involvement a little later along the line, but I don't think that that was ever a serious question or problem.
Then it really was another drastic change that took you to New York.
Well, right. I came back here and interned, and then I was... at that time, it was very difficult to get residencies because the...
excuse us, where did you intern?
At the Western Pennsylvania Hospital, here at Pitt, at Pittsburgh, West Pitt. It was very difficult to get residencies in that day because they were giving preference to veterans who were returning, which was rightly so. And this was a great day of specialization. This is when many people quit their family practices and went into some specialty. So at the... I then left, when I finished my internship at the West Penn, I went over to the VA hospital, which was then in Aspinwall, where I did some internal medicine. It was during this time, people knew I was interested in dermatology. And Bill Guy, who was the chairman of the department here at the university, called me up one day and said, there's a place that's open in New York, would you be interested in going up there? And that's how I got to the New York City Hospital, which I spoke about previously, particularly in relation to my days in New York, and then going up to Columbia Presbyterian, where I would have remained as a member of the faculty if it weren't for the financial hardships at the time, and came back here in 54.
Okay, you've been in private practice in McKeesport, Pennsylvania since 1954?
I've been in private practice since 54, and really I guess I've been practicing in Pittsburgh for about 15 years in some manner. I was appointed to the staff at the West Penn when I came back here, although I did very little work here, and they asked me if I'd like to be a member since I had been an intern there. And through that, I started to get active in the medical community here, and then really started practicing in Pittsburgh about 15 years ago. I was always, as we talked about before, and I don't think we want to repeat this, I was always interested in academic medicine and in some investigative field, and as I said, I was active with Eddie Fisher. About, I guess about 4 years ago or so, the university, which had never had a strong dermatology department, and I don't know what moved them that they would like to develop one, contacted me and asked me if I would be interested in, at least on a part-time basis, taking over the directorship of what was then the Division of Dermatology, and with the idea in mind that they would eventually look for full-time men for this department. I agreed to do that on the basis that we would also think of raising dermatology from a division under the Department of Medicine to a departmental status itself, so it would become a Department of Dermatology. Well, which is true in academia, everything is done by committees, so no one could really give that decision, but at least they did form a committee to investigate this. And the committee, after a period of about a year, did act favorably upon creating a Department of Dermatology at the university, and then to go out and seek a chairman of the department. So when I became active there in 77 as acting director of the Division of Dermatology, I eventually became acting chairman of the Department of Dermatology, as this happened during my 3 years that I remained, and was a member of the ad hoc. I was an ad hoc, I guess not an ad hoc member, an ex officio member of the search committee that finally was formed and chose among the candidates, a chairman of the department. During this time, I was active in teaching and running the department, I also was fortunate and able to raise some money for the department. Mm-hmm. So we were able to obtain about $250,000 or something thereabout for seed money for the new chairman to come in, which became part of the package. And now it's history. It's an ongoing department, and it's rather successful. So it's, that's nice to look back upon. Mm-hmm.
You've also achieved many honors in the medical profession. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I don't know how many honors. I think that I've been lucky in being involved in all aspects of the medical profession. As I said to you earlier, that I felt that, and I do feel that, private practice is a very rewarding sort of activity. And, of course, I've had my fling at academia in my short period that I was heading the program at the University of Pittsburgh. I've also been involved in the mechanics of medicine and in the politics, if you want to say that. And I was elected to the VA director of the American Academy of Dermatology, which is the governing body of the dermatologists. It's not only so for, although it's the American Academy, it also has numerous foreign members. It's looked upon as the academy and society as far as our discipline is concerned. And that was not, the elections there are not by fiat. It's actually a true election. You run against a slate of candidates. A slate of candidates is picked by a nominating committee, and I was fortunate to be in one of those. And I was very lucky that I was elected. So I was able to serve on this body for 4 years. And my last year that I served as a director of the American Academy of Dermatology, I was also a representative to the executive committee. So I was the board's representative to the executive committee of the American Academy of Dermatology, and that was quite an experience. It involved a lot of work, and I think it's something you can only do for a year. So that was, and I am now on national committees now, and have been active in the national affairs of medicine and in particular dermatology. Recently, I was elected a member of the American Dermatological Association. I guess this is the oldest dermatological association in the country, and it consists of about less than 200 dermatologists. I guess it's something that you spend 20 or 30 years trying to get into, and then 20, 30 years keeping everybody else out. I know most of the members of that group and have been involved with them at the national scenes, on the national scene. So but this has been very nice, and I'm pleased that I've been able to enjoy that.
Didn't you also just receive the Gold Cane Award?
Well, that wasn't so long ago. That wasn't just now. This was back in 73 or 72. I was awarded the Gold-Headed Cane at the West Penn Hospital. The Gold-Headed Cane is a symbolic thing, or trophy, I guess, which goes back to 17th century England, 17th or maybe even 16th, where the great physician Radcliffe had this cane, which he handed down to his successor, and it had seven recipients all told. These were the noted physicians of their time, or at least what they thought they were. And the cane now is in the Royal Medical Society across from the Gramercy Park in England. If you haven't seen it, you really ought to go to see it. And so this has kind of become a symbolic thing in medicine, that there are societies and things that give this award for teaching investigation and practicing. Mm-hmm. And the West Penn has made that presentation every year, and I was awarded this cane in I think it was 1973 or something.
Is the youngest doctor ever to receive it?
Well, at that time. But now, there's been quite a few holders of the cane. The cane itself has become quite valuable because they put a gold ring on the cane and inscribe your name on it. So this tradition has been going on at West Penn for over 20 years, so I think that the cane now is worth much more than any of its recipients. So I hope that we don't have to turn it into money.
you've been able to combine many worlds, so to speak, your love of books, your medical profession, and you've also been active in the community in McKeesport. Would you like to tell us about that?
Well, my activity in McKeesport has mainly been in the Jewish community, where I was president of the congregation of Temple B'nai Israel. And
in what year was that?
I think it was about 63 and 64 or around there, maybe 62 or 65, I just can't remember, but it was about that date. And at that time we were a very thriving congregation. I mean, the big issue of the day was that people had bought seats and that the members couldn't attend the high holidays because the big issue of the day was whether members could be present for the high holidays, because in years past the practice was to sell seats, and these were owned by a group of people. And that was a tremendous issue. Now, I guess the big problem is, how do you fill those seats? Unfortunately, years have really taken its toll on the Jewish community in McKeesport, and just how long it's going to survive is very problematical. So, but I was very active in the temple, devoted a great deal of time to it, and in recent years, although I have been rather inactive and probably not as active even as far as religious custom goes as I was, I find that I give whatever help I can even now if situation arises where I can be involved. But that was a great involvement in that time.
Why do you think a lot of these changes occurred in the community of McKeesport?
Well, I think that it's typical of all communities of this type, that these were old towns that were really people's, where people worked and they lived. Today, much of that industry has disappeared, so therefore there's a great migration from the area, or from any area for that point. And there's a different way of doing business. People want the convenience of driving up to a store in their automobile and getting what they want. They don't want to have to walk anywhere. And so consequently, we've seen the demise of these towns of this type. And I guess McKeesport's been a little longer dying than the rest. But certainly the communities about us, all you have to do is drive through them to find out how they disappeared. And the young people have left. We don't have young people.
Why do you think they left?
Well, because I think the grass is greener somewhere else. The opportunity is better, and not only that, the living is better. They can live in a better climate, nicer communities, things of that sort. So I think that this is, there's many points and that would be attracted to someone leaving. I mean, I could never, when I was down in Durham, North Carolina, I would never think of spending my life in the South at that time. But now, this is one of the thriving communities in the country. This is the Research Triangle area in Durham, in North Carolina, is a burgeoning place, and is to this day. So it's interesting how things change.
What do you think would be the future of the Jewish community in McKeesport?
I can't foresee any. It would have to be some event which I'm not thinking about or have considered, or I think other people have. I can't imagine what that would be that would bring people back to areas like that. I do think that there'll be a revival. I do think that we will have some type of industry, and that it may be different than what we know now, and will attract people. But to go back to what we knew, I don't think that we'll see that again. We'll never see a town where on a Saturday night you couldn't walk on the sidewalk because it was packed with people shopping. I think that type of thing is gone. What replaces that doesn't necessarily mean that's good or bad. I think that I should hope everything happens for the better, and whatever will be for the better.
Do you think there will be any Jews living in McKeesport 100 years from now?
Well, I would think so. I think, yes, I would say that because the whole history of our people has been one of tenacity. And I think that we have survived. We're survivors. And I don't see any reason why that should change. That's too embedded in history. I mean, that's just something there. I think that nothing can change that.
Can you contrast the life that your children now have in the big cities compared with you growing up? You pointed out many of the benefits of the type of community and the support systems that you've had.
Well, I think that there's a change in living altogether. I think Eric Koffer, you know, the longshoreman, who's a philosopher, put it very well. He said the higher up the ladder you go, the harder you work. And that that there's a great leisure class has developed. And it's interesting that the leisure class is not necessarily among the leisure rich, but among the working class. Now, whether that's going to survive now as we're on hard times economically, and just how much that's going to have to retrench, I don't know. But recreation is a great industry in this country. And I think that people growing up today, and even those of us here, have enjoyed much more of that than there was a generation ago, involving us as children and involving our parents, similar to what we are today. I think that we worked harder. Today, the 5 day a week is taken for granted. In many places, I guess, it's a 4 day a week. So I think that this affords people more mobility and more money for recreational purposes. So I think that many of the of our children enjoy these things, which we didn't enjoy, or in a very limited manner. So I think their life has changed that much. It's probably that's been a great change in their life. Also, the availability of the automobile now, everyone has their car. As I said in the beginning, during the Depression, it was very nice if one family had a car.
A little while ago, you said that you weren't as religious and weren't as active in the Jewish institutions as before, which seems to be the cry all over. Do you have any explanation for that?
Well, I want to qualify that and say that I'm not less Jewish. I think that really we have an amazing heritage. And it's had great influence on all of us. Although there's a religious revival in the country, you know, if we look around, everybody has been reincarnated, and we find that transcending all religious groups. And actually, if groups are strong among our own, it's the Orthodox groups that are much stronger than in our days, when reform movement was really the thing. And so I don't want to misread this whole thing, but I think that with many of us, and I'm always speaking for myself, really. I guess I shouldn't speak for all of us. I have a very difficult struggle with religion as to its custom and and the its origin. And to me, it's the history of our people that's so utterly fantastic. And we're very rich in what we have, even the written documents and things of that sort. Being a bibliophile, I may be in, a little more appreciative of that than I would be otherwise. And the arts and everything else, and even the thoughts of the people, organization, you know, how they organize it, and things like that. And here again, Hoffer said something that it was the Jew who first worshipped man. Before that time, people worshipped the sun and the mountains and the moon, and these were phenomena that they saw. But the greatest phenomena on earth was not recognized until the Jew said, you know, man was created in the image of God. But that could have been turned around too. But what they're really saying is, this is it. This is the greatest thing. And really, it was our people who recognized that. They were the first to recognize that. So that's a showed a lot of insight on their part. And although I find that I can go, you know, I could really stay away from temple altogether. I don't think that would be difficult for me to do. I could never deny being a Jew.
Many people feel, though, that when you're raised a certain way, these are things that stay with you in these feelings. Do you think that we're really transmitting it to the next generations?
Well, I think that what are we really transmitting? We're transmitting values, things that we think are proper ways to live. And we think, at least in our, and I haven't studied the world's great religion, so I, it's, but at least we're selfish enough. I'm selfish enough to think that we're able to give it to the children for them to have a better way of life. I don't think it necessarily means that they have to carry on custom, although a certain amount of custom goes with it. But the idea is that they know what it is, you know, and why have people died all through the years, being tortured and killed for being a Jew.
Do you think your great grandchildren will be Jewish?
I think they will. I don't have any reason to say that. Only as I feel on a historical basis, I think that they will. I think that the they will. I you know, I used to say to my children, never give up your birthright. And I think that that's a basis of being a Jew. I think that the story of Esau and Isaac and Jacob is probably the whole idea of living, you know? And I somehow feel that this will go on.
Harry, how do you, looking back on your life, how would you view your accomplishments, your successes, your failures?
You don't have enough time, huh? Well, I think that everybody has great desires and ideas and goals. And, you know, you often think about, gee whiz, look how old you are, and what have you achieved? Or how much have you achieved? And as I said to you before, I think I've been lucky. I've been at the right place at the right time, you know, and there is that. And I guess the thing I've been lucky about is being with not the right people, but with good people. And I think that's had a great deal to do with what I've achieved.